The reading tonight is taken from Hebrews 6. I'm going to start reading from verse 19 to the end of chapter 7. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first by translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days or end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who receive the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe, from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, and in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, "You are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek." On the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. And it was not without an oath, for those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath. But this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever." This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office, but he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever.
Let me ask you this evening who you depend on in your life. Who do you lean on to give you support in difficult times? Who is it that you put your weight on? I'm guessing that all of us do have people like that. None of us is entirely self-sufficient. And that's right, isn't it, that we all have people to share the load with in life. And I guess that's what makes bereavement such a horrible thing. One of the terrible things about death is that it takes people away from other people who need them. Other people who were leaning on them. It's like sitting on a chair with four legs and suddenly one of the legs is taken away. Actually, if you've been to dinner at my house, you may well have had that experience, literally, such is the quality of our furniture. But people are like that. Death reminds us that the people we trust in are so fragile. They seem so able, don't they, to prop us up. But then tragedy strikes and we discover that they're no stronger than we are. Their mortality teaches us that they cannot bear our weight in the end. And when our security is ultimately in those people, we set ourselves up for a terrible fall. I guess that's why people got hysterical a few years ago when Princess Diana died, because people looked to her as an anchor of their dreams and ideals. She was a kind of icon of all they wanted to be. But she died, and their hopes came crashing to the floor. She couldn't bear the weight that they put on her. For me, it isn't famous people like Diana that I lean on. It's friends. I'm leaving St. Helens this summer. You might know that. And I must admit that I'm dreading saying goodbye. I almost got quite emotional on Friday night. I went round to see a couple of friends who I've grown to love very much from this church family. People I've leant on and put my weight on. And yet I've realised that I won't see them much, or nearly so much, next year. And ultimately, I won't always have them around. Even more than famous people, we lean on friends. Even more than friends, I guess, we lean on family. A husband or wife, if you're married. And of course, it's the right thing, isn't it, that we depend on one another and help one another. But actually, mortality means that your spouse cannot ultimately bear your weight. I've got a friend down in Cornwall at the moment whose mum is dying of cancer. But it's his dad that I'm really worrying about and praying for. Because when she goes, he'll be lost. Who do you lean on? Who bears your weight in life? Because death will one day take them away. Maybe you think I'm being a bit morbid as I begin this sermon, but I wanted to paint the backdrop against which this chapter is very happy news. I wonder if you noticed the point, even as we heard the chapter read, it's repeated so many times. Jesus is a priest forever. He never dies. He is eternal. And that's why I thought that Hebrews 7 would be a good choice for Easter. Jesus lives forever. And that means that we can put all of our weight on him. The theme actually begins in chapter 5, across the page, verse 9. Being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. See it again in chapter 6, verse 19, just before the beginning of our reading. Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Then 7 verse 3, Melchizedek, resembling Jesus, continues a priest forever. Verse 16, Jesus becomes a priest on the basis of an indestructible life. Verse 17, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Verse 21, verse 24, verse 25, verse 28, you get the point. Jesus is an eternal priest. He's risen from the dead. He's alive today. He lives forever. And that makes him a very great priest. And my prayer is that as we study this chapter this evening, we will realise how glorious Jesus is and how secure we are if we put our trust in him. If you pick up the notice sheet and turn it over, you will discover that it's blank. I'm sorry about that. That's my fault. Often we have an outline of the talk on the sheet. I was away last week at WordLife and I forgot to phone the office in time. But if you are taking notes, there's a nice bit of space for you to write them down on. There's just 2 points, and here they are. Number one, because Jesus is eternal, he is like Melchizedek in his greatness. Number two, because Jesus is eternal, he is unlike the Levites in their weakness. First of all then, because Jesus is eternal, he is like Melchizedek in his greatness. Verses 1 to 10. Now I guess you've often heard preachers struggling to think of an adequate illustration to convey some mind-blowing spiritual truth. Struggling and failing, I should say, and I'm afraid this evening will be no exception. It is very difficult to think of illustrations for something so great as the Lord Jesus. But fortunately for me, the writer of the Hebrews has already come up with an illustration, although it is quite a complicated one. It's the illustration of Melchizedek. You're probably thinking at this point, Mel who? Melchizedek only crops up 3 times in the Bible, here in Hebrews, once in Psalm 110, and then once in Genesis chapter 14. His name is hard to spell, and the more you learn about him, the stranger he seems. It's difficult, but it is important, so let's stick with it. Why don't we turn back to Melchizedek's first appearance in Genesis chapter 14, and it's on page 12 of the Bible. So keep one finger in Hebrews and turn back to page 12. Genesis chapter 14, I'll read from verse 17. After his return from the defeat of somewhere or other, the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet Abraham at the valley of Shaveth, that is the king's valley, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him, Abraham, and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. Well, there we are. That's pretty much everything we know about Melchizedek. It's pretty strange, isn't it? But why don't we turn back to Hebrews and find out why he's such a good illustration of Jesus. Well, for starters, there's a clue in his name. Melchizedek, when you translate it, it means king of righteousness. Melech in Hebrew means king. Zedek means righteousness. Melchizedek, king of righteousness. Genesis also calls him king of Salem. Or Salem in Hebrew, Shalom, means peace. King of peace. So he's king of righteousness, prince of peace. It's kind of starting to ring some bells already, isn't it? But then the most remarkable thing about Melchizedek is in verse 3. He's without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, resembling the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. I want to offer a word of warning to you. If you're at the stage of trying to start a family, that you might want to avoid conceiving towards the end of next month. Next month is May, and 9 months from May is February. And next year's a leap year. So you might just end up with one of those really unhappy babies who only gets a birthday once every 4 years on February the 29th. But for Melchizedek, it's even worse than that. He doesn't just have no birthday once every 4 years. Melchizedek doesn't have a birthday at all. Moreover, he never celebrates Mother's Day either. In Genesis, there's no record of his parents. And that's a pretty old thing, actually. In Genesis, the book where genealogies are so important, where we learn who's grandfather of who and who's the older brother of X and the second cousin of Y, Melchizedek, no mention at all of his lineage. Without father or mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son, he continues a priest forever. We have to ask the question, in what way does he resemble the Son? Without father or mother? Well, no, we're pretty confident that Mary had something to do with Jesus' arrival. Without genealogy, well, no, just check out Matthew chapter 1. You'll see that Jesus got an absolutely huge genealogy. How is it that they're similar? Look again at verse 3. Resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. That's the comparison. His priesthood is eternal. He's got no recorded beginning, no recorded end. That the Melchizedek priesthood is the forever priesthood. That's the comparison. You see, Jesus never dies. He is forever. He is the one you can put all your weight on. Because Jesus is eternal. He is like Melchizedek in his greatness. I was talking with a kind of theological friend yesterday at a wedding, and he said the trouble with Melchizedek is everyone was going to go away from the sermon puzzling about Melchizedek and wondering whether he's still alive today. And I don't know the answer to that. He might be. There's certainly a few anomalies in the Old Testament of people who never seem to die, people like Elijah and maybe Enoch, and maybe Melchizedek's one of them. Or maybe the point is just that his priesthood is forever. I don't really know. The commentaries don't seem to be very clear on it. But I do hope that you won't go away puzzling about Melchizedek, because he's not really the point. He's just the illustration. Jesus is the point. Wonder if you notice that verse 4 reads quite strangely. The writer describes Melchizedek, and then we expect it to say that Jesus is like Melchizedek. That's the paragraph heading in my NIV Bible. But actually it doesn't say that. It says Melchizedek is like Jesus. Melchizedek resembles the Son, not the other way around. In other words, Jesus is the one who it's about. Melchizedek is just the illustration. Don't know what your taste is in architecture, but personally I'm quite a fan of the gherkin next door. I remember back when it was no more than a hole in the ground and the first big triangle arrived. Anyone remember that? And I was fascinated by it, and I found the Norman Foster website, www.30stmaryacts.com, if you're interested. And there I found all the gherkin facts I could ever want. There were kind of artist's impressions, scale drawings, all that kind of thing. In fact, I've even got one of them as the screensaver on my computer. How sad, you're probably thinking. But just imagine how perverse it would be if we had this conversation. Do you like the gherkin? What, you mean that huge bulbous tower next to St. Helens? No, I mean the gherkin, you know, that picture on my computer. That'd be weird, wouldn't it? I mean, the picture on my computer is only the picture. The gherkin is the building next to St. Helens. And so it is with Melchizedek. He's just the picture. He is amazing, just like my screensaver is amazing. But he's only a shadow of who Jesus is. So please don't go away puzzling about Melchizedek and endless details that we're not told about him. Please go away marveling at Jesus. Here's the point again. Because Jesus is eternal, he is like Melchizedek in his greatness. Because Melchizedek is very great. Look at verse 4. See how great this man was. It's pretty clear from the account in Genesis. If you were a Jew, as the first readers of this letter seem to have been, then you'd know that there's no one greater in Judaism than Abraham. He was the great one, the father of the whole Jewish nation. And yet when Abraham meets Melchizedek, he hands over a tenth of his plunder, just like that. What a great one Melchizedek must have been if even Abraham paid him a tithe. Of course, the idea of paying a tenth or a tithe was familiar in the Old Testament. In fact, it was an Old Testament law. You had to pay a tenth to the Levites, the priestly tribe. But Melchizedek wasn't a member of that tribe. He had no ancestry. Just look at verse 6. This man who does not have his descendant from them received tithe from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Well, it's weird, isn't it? He's not a Levite. He doesn't deserve the tithe. So how come he gets a tithe? We'll just look at verse 7 and 8 for the answer. It's beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In the one case, tithes were received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it's testified that he lives. Here's the logic. Because Melchizedek lives, because he is eternal, he's very much greater. greater even than Abraham, greater than the whole priestly tribe of Levi, because you might say, verse 9, that Levi himself, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. The idea is that Abraham was Levi's great-grandfather, and so in a sense, you could say that Levi was kind of still in Abraham's body when he paid the tithe. It's as if Abraham had his genes, his Levi genes. If you'll excuse the pun. I'm sorry, that's poor, isn't it? But here's the point. Melchizedek is very great. Greater even than Abraham. And in that, he resembles the Son who continues a priest forever. Because Jesus is eternal, he is like Melchizedek in his greatness. Let me ask you, as I ask myself this evening, do you see how great Jesus is because he is eternal? Do you see that because he's alive today, risen from the dead, never to die again, do you see that because of that he is greater than anyone who has ever lived? And do we see, I wonder, that because he is so great, he is the one to trust in to get us to God? He is the one to lean on, to put our weight on. He is the one who will never die, and so will never let us down. Because Jesus is eternal, he is like Melchizedek in his greatness. Secondly, though, because Jesus is eternal, he is unlike the Levites in their weakness. In the Old Testament, there was a system of priests called Levites who served as a kind of go-between between God and his people. So if you wanted to approach God in the Old Testament, you had to do so with the help of a Levite. You go and find yourself a Levite. But Jesus is unlike the Levites. And to see that, we don't need to look any further than his surname. I don't mean Christ. Some people think that Christ is Jesus' surname. It isn't. It's a kind of title. It means king, King Jesus. I guess if Jesus did have a surname, it would be Judah, because that's the tribe that Jesus came from, verse 14. And that enough should be that alone should be enough to tell us that he's different from the Levites. Because Jesus is eternal, he is unlike the Levites in their weakness. Let me explain. I've heard it said that if you want to get a job in the Foreign Office, you have to have been to the right school. Now, maybe that sounds scandalous. I don't know if it's true, but I've heard that. I don't really care because I don't really want to work at the Foreign Office. But you get the idea. It's a kind of exclusive thing. But if you want to be a member of the British monarchy, it's even more exclusive. It's not enough just to have gone to school down the road from Windsor. Your surname has to be Windsor. And if your surname isn't Windsor, then no matter how hard you try, unless you can persuade one of them to marry you, you can't be a member of the royal family. And it's a bit like that with the priests. Unless you were born into the tribe of Levi, unless your surname was Levi, you couldn't be a priest, full stop. There's nothing you could do about it. It was in the law. Priests had to be Levites. And Jesus wasn't a Levite. He couldn't have become a priest through the normal channels, you see. He had to become a totally different kind of priest, altogether different. And he did that because he is eternal. Look at verses 15 to 17 with me. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. See, Jesus isn't a priest because of his genealogy. Rather, he is a priest because of his indestructible life. Because Jesus is eternal, he is unlike the Levites in their weakness. I want you to do a bit of the work for me. Just to look down at verse 11 and see if you can follow the logic. I'll give you a moment. Verse 11. Do you see the point? If there was nothing wrong with the first priesthood, the Levite priesthood, there would be no need for Jesus to come along. There must have been something defective about them if we needed a new priesthood, a Melchizedek priesthood. There must have been something wrong. And there was. They were weak. Verse 18, verse 28. Weak. And they were weak in two ways. For one thing, they were mortal. Look at verse 23 with me. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. Just imagine what it would have been like. You get to know one of the priests, a lovely young chap called John Levi, or whatever his name was. And he does the sacrifices for you at the temple. And he enables you and your family to draw near to God. And as time goes on, you get to know John Levi quite well. And you establish a bit of a rapport with him. And that's great news for your relationship with God. John Levi helps you. But then one day you turn up and he snuffs it. And he's dead. And you have to start all over again with someone else. The priests were no good. They were defective because they died. But just compare Jesus, verse 23 again. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Actually, the problem of the Levites is worse than just that they die. The thing is, if it was just that they died, there's always a replacement coming along, isn't there? It's quite a big family, the Levites, so one of them dies and you get someone else in. And whilst it's a bit of a pain, eventually you can get to know the new Levite and he can start doing the sacrifices for you and then, hey, you're okay. But actually the problem was bigger than just that they died. The problem is that because they died, they showed that they could never really help you in the first place. How could the priest possibly deal with the problem of sin and death if they themselves sinned and they themselves died? Just imagine you're walking through a cemetery. I don't know if you ever look at bizarre epitaphs on cemeteries. I've seen some quite weird ones, I must admit, in my time. But imagine you see one like this. On one of the tombstones, it reads, "Here lies the body of John Smith, alchemist, discoverer of the secret of immortality, R.I.P. It'd be pretty weird, wouldn't it? Or imagine this obituary in the Times. "In memory of Professor Mark Jones, graduate of King's College London, received his PhD from Harvard, winner of the Nobel Prize for finding a cure for cancer, died tragically of cancer." Be bizarre, wouldn't it? Those people's deaths illustrate that they haven't got the cures that they profess to have. And so it was with the Levites. They too were sinners. And they too died. They were weak, you see. But Jesus is unlike them. Read with me from verse 26. "For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those other high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins, and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever." Because Jesus is eternal, he is like Melchizedek in his greatness. Because Jesus is eternal, he is unlike the Levites in their weakness. Jesus is not weak. He's not mortal. He's great. And he is eternal. He is alive today. He lives forever. And that means that he is able to save us completely. Just look at verse 25. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost, or literally, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for us. Can I urge you then to lean on Jesus, to put all of your weight on him? He is the one who will never let you down. It might be that there's someone here this evening and you're conscious that you're a long way from God at the moment. You've turned your back on him, or you've done something stupid and you wonder if God can forgive you. Let me encourage you to draw near to him today through Jesus. You can do that today because Jesus is alive today, interceding at God's right hand, and he is able to save you. He can save us today. He can save me in 40 years' time when, as an old man, I'm still struggling as a Christian, because Jesus will still be alive then. And in 10,000 years' time, if you're a Christian, we'll be in heaven. And Jesus will still be a priest through whom we can draw near to God. He is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him. I wonder if we realize how secure we are in Jesus because he is alive forever. Death will never stop him in office. We'll never be bereaved of Jesus. He'll never be the leg of the chair that falls off and brings us crashing to the floor. Jesus is the Melchizedek priest, the forever priest. But of course, there is a flip side to all this. Nobody else can save like that. There are no other forever priests. And so this passage says to us, don't turn away from Jesus. The first readers of this letter were in danger of doing that. They were in danger of giving up on Jesus and turning back to the Levites, turning to other people to get them close to God. And that would be a ridiculous thing to do. Don't do that, says the writer. Don't go to Mary or to the saints. They're dead, for goodness sake. It would be ridiculous to go to dead people to help you when you have a priest who lives forever. Don't lean on William Taylor, the rector. He's a great Bible teacher, but he's not a great priest. He's weak and he's mortal. He can't get you close to God. And even if he could, one day he'll die and be taken away from us. Wouldn't it be a terrible thing if the death of William Taylor meant the end of St. Helens? But actually, that kind of stuff can happen when church leaders die. We mustn't lean on them that much. Don't put your weight on your Bible study leader. Don't put your weight on your friends or even on your spouse. I don't mean that we shouldn't help and support one another. Of course we should. But I do mean that we cannot bear one another's spiritual weight, and we should not try to. Otherwise, through bereavement, one day, we will lose the person who was propping up our whole Christian life, and it will come crashing down. We'll be like that chair in my house with the rotten leg that suddenly gives way. No, trust in Jesus, the one who lives, the one who is eternal, like Melchizedek in his greatness, unlike everyone else in our weakness. I wonder if we can have just a moment's silence, just to think of people and things that we might be leaning on, and to transfer that weight to the Lord Jesus. Let's have a moment's silence, and then I'll pray.